Okay, so I'm Roland Speicher and I'm sharing the course on free probability together with Jamie Mingo. So I'm going to talk today and next week. And Jamie showed you last time somehow how the crucial notion in free probability theory, the concept of freeness, shows up in random matrices. And today I want to show you the other important field, occurrence of freeness, namely operator algebras. And that was actually where the whole notion came up. So this connection with random matrices was only realized later by Voiculescu. So the reason for introducing freeness was really because he was interested in understanding some special Fournierian algebras. Okay, so I want to start with giving you the background on this problem and then showing you how this notion of freeness comes up very canonical in this context. I mean, it's not nothing really very deep, but the main point is really to realize that you have this structure and then try to understand it. Okay, so in this lecture I want to talk about operator algebras and freeness. And let me start by give you some background. Maybe you have seen those things, but just recall the basic facts about the Fournierian algebras in which Voiculescu was interested, namely the free group factors. Or more general, Fournierian algebras which are related with a group. Okay, so let us consider a group, let's say a discrete group, so topology doesn't really play a role, and then there's a very canonical way to associate to such a group the C-star algebra and the Fournierian algebra. Also namely what is called the reduced C-star algebra of G and L of G. Also the first one is a C-star algebra and the second is a Fournierian algebra. And the construction is actually quite canonical. Namely, essentially you take the left representation of the group on itself and you just close it in the corresponding topologies. Okay, so let me be a bit more precise on this. So let me denote by C of G the group algebra of the group. Also, these are finite linear combinations of group elements. So it's finite sums over linear combinations of group elements. Let me denote this by alpha G times delta of G. I could write just G, but maybe let me denote the group element in this context by delta of G. And these alphas are just complex numbers. This is the group algebra. Of course, it has an algebra structure, but first of all, maybe I should make a Hilbert space out of it because I want to represent my group algebra on itself. So first, I should get a Hilbert space. So I should have an inner product, and I mean, of course, this is very canonically. Namely, I declare any two group elements as orthonormal. Okay, so I have an inner product just by saying delta G, comma delta H, for G and H two group elements, is either 0 or 1, depending on whether G is the same as H or whether it's different. So it's G is equal to 1, or otherwise. Okay, and then of course I extend this by linearity to arbitrary elements in the group algebra. And of course, so this gives me an inner product, which means I also get a corresponding norm, and then of course I can complete this space here in this norm. So I'm allowing not only finite sums, but infinite sums, where of course the coefficients are square summable. Okay, so this gives me an L2 norm. Just given by taking the square root, the inner product of A with itself, for A any element in the group algebra, and then of course I can complete this space with respect to this norm, and this gives me a Hilbert space, which I denote by L2 of T. So this is the group algebra completion with this norm. And this is a Hilbert space. Okay, and of course, I mean, this is nothing else than really the usual L2 of G. So it's just the square sum of the functions on G. Well, I mean, you can think of delta of G really as a function on G. And I mean, the elements in the group algebra are nothing than finitely supported functions from G to C. Also, you can think of those objects also as group elements, as functions. Good. Okay. And now, so now we have a Hilbert space, which essentially consists of linear combinations of group elements. And now we take the group algebra, we let it act on this object. So we let the group essentially act on itself and just extend everything by linearity. And of course we let it act by multiplication. So now let G act on the space L2 of G. And let me denote this action by lambda. So it's the left regular representation. So how acts a group element G on such an element in the Hilbert space? And it acts, yeah, it acts just by multiplying it from the left. So it's enough essentially to say how it acts on the group element itself. The rest follows by linearity and completion. So lambda of G on delta of H, of course, should just be delta of G of H for G and H in G. Okay. Or, I mean, more general, I mean, if I have an element in L2, so it's just the sum with square general coefficients, and of course this is alpha h delta of g of h, and of course from this it is clear that the norm doesn't change under this action because it's just the sum of the squares of those guys here, and I mean here it's the same also, so I mean it's clear that the norm of lambda g is the same as the norm before for any L2 of G. Oh, okay, so this lambda G is an isometry, but actually it's even more, namely it's a unitary, which is also very easy to see. So why is this? Because I mean lambda of G, yeah, well, what is the adjoint of lambda of G? It's actually a lambda of G to the minus 1. So why this? Because, okay, let's see. So lambda G on delta H delta K, so what is this? I mean this here acts by multiplying. So this is delta of gh, delta of k, and the inner product just checks whether this is the same as this. So this just is one if gh is the same as k. Okay, but of course we can also essentially bring the g on the other side here. I mean this is the same, so gh being the same as k is the same as saying that h is the same as g to the minus 1 k. Okay, but this of course is delta of h, and then multiply g to the minus 1 on the element delta of k. Okay, so we see we can bring lambda of g on the other side in the inner product, and the minus appears there. Okay, so this tells us that g to the minus 1 is actually in this, under this action, the adjoint. G to the minus 1 is lambda of g star, and of course, I mean, lambda is a homomorphism, so I mean, if I'm, yeah, the product of two multiplications is the same as multiplying directly with the product of the group elements. So this means, of course, that lambda of g times lambda of g star, lambda of g star, as we have seen, is lambda of g to the minus 1. Okay, but lambda is a homomorphism, so it's lambda of the unit of the mutual element in the group, but of course the action of this is does nothing. So this is just the identity operator. So this is one. And of course the same in the other way, so this really tells us that lambda is actually a unitary element. Okay, so all group elements are represented as unitary operators in this representation. Okay, so lambda of G acts on L2 of G as a unitary operator, in particular as a bounded operator. Okay, now of course I can extend this action from the group to the group algebra just by linearity. Also, I extend lambda, my action from G to C of G, just in a linear way. So this means how does an element in the group algebra, let me denote it by alpha g, maybe now I write g, now I really want to consider this as an algebra, so maybe I don't put the delta there, but of course it's the same element. Okay, so this is a finite sum over linear combinations of G, and of course by linearity, of course this should be the same as alpha G times lambda of G. Okay, and because we know, I mean, that each lambda of G is a unitary operator, a bounded operator, this is a finite sum, of course this means that this is a bounded operator. So this tells me that every element in the group algebra is represented as a bounded operator on this space L2 by this left multiplication. So what I have, so lambda is a representation of the group algebra in the bounded operators in L2 of G. Okay, now I have an algebra embedded in a bounded operator, and now I can of course take the closure of this algebra in the various topologies which are around. And I mean, okay, there are essentially two types of topologies around. On one side, the uniform or the operator topology. If I close this guy in this topology, I will get a sister algebra. And on the other side, I mean, I have these strong and weak topologies. I mean, the closure under those will give always the same object. And I mean, this is a much bigger object, and this is a von Neumann algebra. Okay, and that's the two objects which one gets in this context. So namely, if I close it, close this in the operator norm, then I get a reduced C-star algebra of my group. Reduced C-star algebra of the group. So this is lambda of G of G. So these are the elements in the group algebra, but considered as operators acting by left multiplication on the Hilbert space L2 of G. Closing this, so taking everything which I can approximate in the operator norm by elements from here. So this is still, of course, something in the bounded operators. This is a C-star algebra. So the reduced C-star algebra of G. And if I close it in the strong topology, then I get the so-called von Neumann algebra of the group, which is usually denoted by L of G. So L of G is lambda C of G closed in the, let's say, the strong operator topology. I could also take the weak. I mean, all those other topologies give the same in the closure. Okay, so this is also sitting in B of L2 of G. Good, so I'm getting two nice objects, which are very important, and I mean, very nice examples for C-star algebras and von Neumann algebras. And, okay, I mean, we are mostly interested in the von Neumann algebra. And I mean, these von Neumann algebras are really very nice ones. So they have nice properties, and in particular, they are type 2-1. So this means there is a trace around. So L of G is type 2-1. So that's this classification of von Neumann algebras in type 1, 2, and 3. And I mean, type 1 are the trivial ones, B of H's. Well, yeah. Okay, and 2-1 is somehow the interesting one, which are not B of H, but nevertheless, they have a trace. Okay, so I'm claiming that there is a trace on this, on those von Neumann algebras. Okay, and how is it given? Okay, this trace comes, it's a vector state coming from the only special element in my group, which is the neutral element in the group. So it's just a vector state corresponding to the neutral element. So it's given by tau. So this goes from L of G and tau of A is so it's the neutral element in the group. So it's the vector state delta E comma A delta E. Okay. I mean, maybe I should put lambda of A here, but in the following I will just omit the lambda because I identify the group element with its action on B. Okay. So it's just the inner product of A acting on the neutral element, inner product with itself. So of course I can define this for any element, for any bounded operator in my Hilbert space. Okay, but the point is, I mean, this is a trace, of course, not on all bounded operators, but restricted to this object here, it is a trace. Okay, so let us make the definition just for this, and E here is the neutral element in G. Okay, so maybe one should check why is this a trace. I mean, it is a very simple observation. It is nothing deep, but nevertheless, it gives us quite interesting structure of those phenomena, I suppose. So why is it a trace? Okay, so a trace means that we should see that tau of AB is the same as tau of BA. And I mean, for doing this, essentially, it's enough to check this for elements in the group. Because if you have it for elements in the group, it goes over to linear combinations, and then it also goes over to the closure. Because, I mean, states like this have all the nice continuity properties, so they are normal. So it's really enough to check it for group elements. But what is, so if G and H are two group elements in the group G, what is tau of GH? So this is delta E, comma GH, given delta E. Okay, what is this? I mean here GH acts by multiplication, so this is delta of GH, and the inner product just checks whether these two are the same, so this just asks whether GH is equal to E. Well, so this is 1 or 0, depending on whether HG is a neutral element or not. And if I do it in the other way, what is tau of HG, then of course just the role of G and H are exchanged. So what I get here is 1 or 0, depending on whether GH is the identity or not. Okay, and so we see that those are the same, just the easy observation that the left inverse of a group element is the same as the right inverse. Oh, okay, which of course is true. Okay, so the right inverse is the same as the left inverse, which gives me the trace property. So this simple fact just translates into the trace property of this tau, and as I said, I mean, having it here, it goes over to all L of G. So I actually have a trace on L of G. Then another fact, which is quite easy, is that in many cases those phenomena algebras are actually factors. So they have a trivial center. Okay, so I mean, this is not always true. I mean, this depends on the group. And I mean, actually, I mean, what I'm doing here, if you do it for finite groups, I mean, you don't have to take any closure. What I'm doing here is just to taking the left regular representation. And of course, you know that this decomposes into a direct sum of the irreducible representations. And of course, this is usually not a factor. If you have direct sums, you have a center. But in the infinite dimensional situation, usually you get a factor. Okay, so and I mean, in this situation, what you need is that your group is ICC, which means that the non-trivial conjugacy classes should all be infinite. It means, of course, that you need an infinite group, but of course, it's a stronger. Good. Okay, so it's an easy fact. I mean, I'm not going to prove it, but I mean, it's also not very, very deep. Is that if G is what is called ICC, so this stands for infinite conjugacy classes, and it means that the conjugacy class for each group element, different from the neutral element, G different from E, the corresponding conjugacy class, so this is the set of H, G, H to the minus 1, where H is running over the group, that they should be infinite. Of course, for E, this is just consists of E, okay, but for all the other ones, this should be infinite. Should have infinitely many elements. Okay, and if I have such a group, and there are many groups of this type, then it is easy to see that L of G is a factor. Okay, so which means that it has a trivial center. So there is no element, with the exception of multiples of the identity, in my algebra, which commutes with every other element in the algebra. Good. Okay. And I mean, actually, this also shows me that L of G is a quite interesting object, namely that it is not equal to B of H. Well, I mean, if I just make a definition like this, I mean, I take a subalgebra in B of H and I close it in some topology, I mean, I don't know what I get. I might just get B of H, which is not very, very interesting. Okay, but the fact that I have a trace shows me that it cannot be B of H. Also, I mean, the trace is one of the nice invariants which I have for normal algebras. So, namely, of course, if H is finite dimensional, I have a trace. But I mean, in this situation, my Hilbert space will be infinite dimensional, and on B of H, for an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, there exists no trace, which can be defined on the whole Hilbert space. Okay, but on the other hand, we know that we have a trace here. So this means that L of G cannot be the whole of B of H. And I mean, this was actually one of the first constructions of Murray and von Neumann of non-trivial von Neumann algebras. I mean, first of all, it's actually, I mean, if you want to talk about von Neumann algebras, I mean, of course, you know the B of H's, but it's not so clear whether there's anything else. Right? If you just start with taking some operator in the Hilbert space and you close it in your topology, you don't really know what you get. The weak topology, I mean, is really very weak, so you usually take a lot of things. You have a lot of things in the closures, and it might be that you just get everything. Okay, but I mean, an argument like this shows you that you don't get everything. So actually, L of G is just somehow a small part of B of H. Okay. So this shows that if G is ICC, then this L of G cannot be B of H. But it's really it's a more interesting von Neumann algebra. Okay, and of course, the canonical question is somehow how much structure of your group survives in this von Neumann algebra. Okay, and I mean, of course, there are different groups might give you the same von Neumann algebra. And I mean, one knows, for example, that if G is immutable, then actually you always get the same von Neumann algebra. Namely, you get the simplest to one factor, and namely the hyperfinite one to one factor. So then L of G is always the same, which is hyperfinite factor, which is usually denoted by R. And that's a factor about which we know quite a lot of deal. Huh? I mean, the hyperfinite von Neumann algebras are more or less quite well understood. I mean, by the work of Collins also, we know quite a lot about them. But now the interest of Vaiculescu was somehow to go beyond this and looking on other interesting examples. Okay, and a very canonical non-amenable group are the free groups. So what we really want to consider now are the free groups, G of Fn. So this is the free group on n generators. So I have n elements and their inverses and every word which I can get by them, and I have no relation in my group. Okay, and I mean this group is ICC. Quite easy to see. So this means it really gives me a 2-1 factor. And it was, I mean, okay, G is not amenable, but I mean, okay, this implication doesn't mean necessarily that I don't get a hyperfinite factor, but it was actually shown by Murray and von Neumann that the free group factor which I get here is not isomorphic to the hyperfinite factor. So actually they introduced some kind of invariant for von Neumann algebras to distinguish this. Well, so this was, I mean, these von Neumann papers were around 1930, 40, yeah? Here or? Probably. I mean, I'm talking about discrete groups, so I suppose it should be countable. Or it doesn't make... No, I mean, for the free group, for example, I could take a free group of uncountably many generators. But in a sense, I mean, they are not, I mean, I think this situation for them is somehow trivial, or it's pathological. So they are not so interesting. Yeah, okay, I mean, those things are too big, so, too wild, so let us stick with this one. Okay, so I'm taking the free group and the corresponding von Neumann algebra, L of Fn, that is what is called the free group factors. And that's what one would like to understand better. So the idea is, I mean, that these are very canonical groups, so this should be some kind of nice von Neumann algebras, and they are different from the hyperfinite one. And actually, I mean, this is a class which should have some nice properties and for which we should develop tools and trying to understand them better. But actually, I mean, the only thing which was known about them up to maybe 10, 15 years ago was that they are not a hyperfinite sector. But after this work of von Neumann, I mean, there was really no progress about them. I mean, it's very hard to understand the structure of this. Okay, and the idea of Voiculescu, the goal of Voiculescu, and I mean, that's the reason why he invented free probability theory, was to try to understand the structure of these free group factors in a better way. And I mean, of course, there's one very canonical question around in this context, namely whether those von Neumann algebras depend on N, whether they are isomorphic or not for different N. So that's the free group isomorphism problem, which is still open, but which... I mean, you can approximate it by countable things, huh? So can't you?
But you wouldn't have an uncountable number of freely independent generators.
No, I mean, if you make a finite decomposition of something, then they are freely independent. But I mean, you can't make a decomposition into, or can you? Into uncountably many things? No, probably not. But anyhow, I mean, let us just stick with a finite number. Yeah. Okay, good. So the goal of Voiculescu was to understand the structure of L of Fn, and I mean maybe in particular hoping to solve eventually this free group factor isomorphism problem. Which asks the following, namely whether two of such free group factors for a different number of generators, whether they are isomorphic or not. So whether L of Fn is isomorphic to L of Fm, so let me speak question here, if n and m are different, then I mean both of them should be bigger than 2, because I mean if you just have 1, then F1 is just flat, and then you just have a commutative von Neumann algebra, which is of course different from the other ones. Okay, so it's only interesting for n and m bigger than 2. Okay, so that's a big question, and I mean, it's still open, but we know, I mean, free probability has provided us some information on them. So, I mean, something we know at the moment is that all of them are either isomorphic or they are pairwise disjoint. Okay, so, and I think in some later lecture we will show how free probability gives this. Okay, but maybe one should note that this is really a problem on the level of the von Neumann algebras. I mean, on the level, of course, on the group level, of course, the groups with a different number of generators are not isomorphic. And I mean, this actually, the same is true for the C-star algebras. So if you just take the closure, I mean, so the group algebras are also not isomorphic. And if you take the closure in the operator norm, then they are still not isomorphic. I mean, this was shown by Voiculescu and Pinchner in the 80s by using K-theory. Okay, so you can calculate the K-theory of those von Neumann algebras, and this allows you to distinguish them. So in a sense, I mean, this was somehow easy. I mean, not really easy, because you really need this theory of K-theory, but I mean, it could be done within a year or so. Okay, but I mean, since then, Voiculescu is thinking about the von Neumann algebra. Yeah, but at least, I mean... Yeah, okay. Don't say this is recorded here, so... Okay, so... Okay, so it's sure that on system level you have a lot of invariants. I mean, K theory gives you a lot of invariants for system algebras, but for phenomenal algebras it's much harder. I mean, the K theory essentially just corresponds to distinguishing type 1, 2, and 3, which is not a very, very fine distinction. Okay, so we know that C-star algebras are not isomorphic. So by Pinchner and Voiculescu. So I think around 1982. Good. Okay, but since then, I mean, the question, yeah, since then Voiculescu thought about the question on the phenomenal algebra level, and I mean, he started to introduce free probability for trying to get your hands on this. Good. Okay, and what is the idea of free probability in the context of this question? I mean, of course, somehow on the level of the group, I mean, what you have here, the free group, you have somehow a free product in the background. I mean, of course, the free group is the free product, the free group on n generators is the free product of n copies of set. So, and of course, I mean, so in a sense, you can understand the free group if you understand the notion and the concept of a free product. And the question is whether this concept of a free product can be transferred from the level of the groups also to the level of the phenomenal algebras. And that's actually what freeness provides us. Okay, so I mean, we know that f of n is isomorphic to the free product of n copies of set. So this is just a free product of groups. And the free product of groups is just an algebraic construction. It just means that you have a new group, and I mean you find three old groups as a subgroup, but you don't have any new relation between the several groups, with the exception that you identify the neutral element. Of course, they all have to be the same, but apart from this, there's no relation. And so the question is whether this operation of taking a free product can be somehow transferred to the level of a Neumann algebra. So can we understand L of Fn in a similar way as kind of free product of a Neumann algebra? So can we say that L of Fn is isomorphic to L of set, free product of L of set? And I mean, L of Z, this is just a commutative phenomenal algebra. This is something which you understand quite well. So the main point would really be to understand this operation. But I mean, a priori, it's not really clear what we mean with this. So that's really, I mean, one of the points that we have to make this precise. And freeness is what makes this precise. But you have to be careful. I mean, the problem is, I mean, here we are dealing with group elements, or we could go over to the group algebra, then we have finite linear combinations, and then somehow it is clear what it means that we don't have algebraic relations. Well, that's what the algebraic concept of freeness says, we don't have algebraic relations. Okay, but if we go to the closure, then we are dealing with infinite sums, and then it's not so clear anymore on algebraic level what it should mean that we don't have algebraic relations between various elements, because you always have to take limits into account. Oh, good. Okay, so this means it doesn't really make sense to talk about freeness on the level of the phenomenal algebras in algebraic way, but what makes sense is to reformulate the information in a way which involves the state tau. Because, I mean, the state is something which we also have here, so if we can somehow reformulate the information about the absence of relations with the help of tau, then, I mean, there's a chance that we can extend this to the phenomenal algebra. Okay, and so this means, first of all, that somehow we are shifting our interest in this phenomenal algebra from maybe looking on concrete representation of elements, how they act on the Hilbert space, by looking on their moments, by looking how tau acts on them. Okay, so and maybe that's the next thing I want to talk about, namely that we are shifting somehow our interest to moments of our operators, and of course we certainly should understand what this means for the phenomenology process. Okay, so let me now talk about moments and the isomorphism of phenomenon algebra. So what we want to do is essentially we want to try to understand phenomenon algebra by understanding moments of generators of them with respect to a state. Okay, now maybe let me start just making some definitions, just some notations which we are going to use. It's just a language. So let's say M is a phenomenon algebra and we have a state on it. So typically M will be one of these L of G and phi will be our state tau. And then we are concentrating our attention to some element in the phenomenon algebra. And what we are looking at is the action of phi on any polynomial in these things. And that's what we are going to call just moments or joint moments of these operators. Okay, so these are just the numbers. Phi applied to any product of the A's in any order and of any length, so A of I1 up to A of IL, where L is just any natural number, and the indices are just running about whatever is possible, so they are just any possibility of I1 up to IL lying between 1 and K. Okay, so those numbers are called the joint moments of these things here. Okay, I mean, we are starting to use a kind of probabilistic language. I mean, free probability is looking on this kind of questions from a, let's say, probabilistic angle. But I mean, this means that essentially we are using probabilistic kind of language and we are inspired by classical probability theory. Okay, but I mean, it's essentially just a language. So we are calling those numbers joint moments. Of our operators A1 up to AK, and if we take all those joint moments together, that's what we are going to call the distribution of A1 up to AK. So the collection of all joint moments, this is the distribution. Of A1 up to AK. Okay, and then I mean in general, I mean the A's don't have to be self-adjoint, then of course we also have the A star around, and I mean usually we should also then understand the moment in A and A star, so that's what we are going to call the star moment or the star distribution. Okay, so I mean we're talking about star moments and the star distribution, so I'm not going to write it down now, but this means in the star moment I also allow that I have stars at any possible position here. And the collection of all star moments is the star distribution. Okay, so now somehow we are shifting our interest in those moments. And of course you might first ask, I mean, does this really, I mean, aren't we losing any information about our phenomenon algebra if we are just looking on such distribution of elements? Well, I mean, it's a very easy observation that essentially if you know the star distribution of the generators of a phenomenon algebra with respect to a faithful state, then you know everything about the phenomenon algebra. Then you're not using information. So I mean this is quite an important statement. It's quite easy, it's not very deep, but nevertheless No, here not. But I mean now, I mean, of course, I mean just for making these definitions and for making a lot of general statements, you don't need faithfulness. But I mean, if you don't want to lose information about your phenomenon algebra by just looking on phi, then phi should be faithful. Okay, so in the next theorem, I mean, what I'm going to write down now, it should be faithful. Okay, so let us consider two phenomenon algebras generated by generators. So let us say M is a phenomenon algebra which is generated by A1 up to AK, and N is another von Neumann algebra, which is generated by some generators B1 up to BK, and assume you have a faithful normal state on each of them. So let phi be a faithful normal state on M, phi a faithful normal state on N. And assume that the star distribution of the A's with respect to phi is the same as the star distribution of the B's with respect to psi. So this means that any moment of the A's under phi is the same as the corresponding moment under psi, or moment of the B's under psi. Okay, so we assume that phi of any star moment AI1 up to AIL, where I also can put stars or not stars at any position, so let me denote this by epsilon1 up to epsilon L, that this should be the same as psi of the corresponding expression in the B, so BI1 up to BIL, I have the same indices here, and I put the stars at the same position, of course, so I have here epsilon1 up to epsilon L, so I have this for all possible lengths of my words. For all allowed indices, I1 up to IL, between 1 and K, and for all choices of the epsilons of being star or not star. Okay, so let me denote this by epsilon 1 up to epsilon L. They can be either a star, or they can be nothing, or let's say a 1. Okay, A to the power 1 means nothing. Okay, so if I assume this, then actually I get a canonical isomorphism between those two von Neumann algebras. So of course it is clear what this isomorphism should be, namely it sends AI to BI. But the point is that this actually, extends to an isomorphism of the von Neumann algebra. So thus, AI goes to BI for all I between 1 and K. This extends to a star isomorphism from M to N. So in particular, the two von Neumann algebras are isomorphic. Okay. And let me just recall what faithful means for a state. Okay, so phi faithful by definition means that if phi vanishes on a positive element, then this positive element must be equal to zero. So if phi of A star A is equal to zero, then this means that A must itself be zero. Good. Okay, this theorem is not very deep. Essentially it's just the assumption here show you that the GNS construction of phi of N with respect to phi and of N with respect to psi are isomorphic, and so you get this isomorphism directly. If you want to put it more concretely, what do you have? What is the point essentially here? Of course you can send AI to BI, and of course you send then any polynomial in the AIs to the corresponding polynomial in the BIs, but of course you must check that this is actually consistent, namely that it doesn't happen that you have a relation on this side between the AIs which you don't have on this side, or the other way around. So essentially you have to check that if you have a polynomial in the AIs which vanishes, then the same polynomial in the BIs must also vanish, because otherwise you couldn't extend this in a consistent way. Okay, and this equality of the moments really gives you this. Because if you know that you have a polynomial in the AIs, if you know that this is equal to zero, then in particular you also know that this is equal to zero, so in particular under phi it is equal to zero. This is just some polynomial in the AIs, but under phi this is the same as psi applied to the same polynomial under the BIs. So this means, by our assumption on the equality of the distributions, this is the same as psi applied to the same polynomial in the BIs. which is this one. But now because psi is faithful, and I mean this is of the form AA star, you know that this polynomial itself must be equal to zero. Oh, okay. And I mean then of course I mean you have to go over to the closure essentially. But I mean because your states are normal, you can extend this to the closure. Huh? Okay, so but the main point is, I mean, the equality of the moment ensures you that you don't have relations on one side which you don't have on the other side. Okay, good. So this tells us that if we are working with faithful states and we are just looking on moments of generators of our algebra, we are not losing information about the von Neumann algebra. Of course, the question in this context, I mean, is we are interested in these L of G's, and the state which we are going to use, of course, is a canonical trace, so it's of course a question whether this is faithful or not. Okay, but this actually is, and this is again a simple observation, but it should be made, so one should note that our state tau, this trace, on the L of G's, is actually a faithful state. And I mean, as a vector state, it is also normal. That's not a problem. But faithfulness might not be so clear directly. I mean, it's quite easy to see from the construction. Again, so what would you have to see? So we have to take an element A, which vanishes, such that A star A vanishes under tau, and then we have to see that this element is actually equal to zero. Okay, but so what is tau of A star A? By the definition of tau, this is A star A applied to delta E, and then the inner product is delta E. Okay, so we can bring A star on the other side. So it's A on delta E, comma A on delta E. So this is equal to zero, which means, of course, that A acting on delta E is equal to zero. Okay, so this condition means that A acting on this special vector, namely the neutral element, is equal to zero, and what we are claiming is that A itself has to be equal to zero. So it must be actually zero acting on everything in the Hilbert space. Okay, so but we are saying that if we know it's zero on the neutral element, it's zero everywhere. And, okay, I mean, there are various possibilities for seeing this. So what we have to show, in order to show that our tau is faithful, we have to show that A itself is equal to zero. Okay, or we could also say that if we are acting with A on any inner product of the A's, should be equal to zero. So if we act on, so we have to show that of any of such inner products for any psi and eta in our Hilbert space are equal to zero. But then again, it's enough to show this for the case where I take the elements from the group. Because any element in my Hilbert space is the closure of some linear combinations of elements from the group. So if I have it for elements in the groups, I get it for linear combinations, and then I can go over to the closure. So it's enough to show this if I take the arbitrary element from the group. So enough to take, let's say, psi is delta of G, and eta is delta of H. In the general case follows by linearity and continuity. And then, yeah, what is this here then? Then you have A of delta G, comma delta H. Yeah, so what is this? This is A. Okay, and delta G, of course I can reduce this. This is G acting on delta E, and on the other side, H acting on delta E. Okay, and then this is the same as delta E of G to the minus 1, A to the minus 1, H of delta E. And now you see what I have here is actually a tau applied to this element. And then I can use essentially the tracial property of tau. So this is tau of this element here, g to the minus 1, a to the minus 1. No, here I should take a star because this is not a group element necessarily. Okay, H. Okay, but then by the threshold property of tau, which you already know, I can move this to the back, and then I have the A star here, and then you see this allows me to act with A direct in delta of V. So this is the same as tau of A star H V to the minus 1. So which is, if I write down again what tau actually is, this is delta E of A star H V to the minus 1 on delta E. But now I can move this A star as A on the other side, and then A acts on delta E. But that's what we know, what we assume, that A acting on delta E on the neutral element is equal to 0. So the whole thing is equal to 0. So this is A acting on delta E, which is equal to 0. So this means the knowledge that A acting on delta E is equal to 0 shows me that A acting on any group element is equal to 0, which means A must be 0 itself. Acting on everything must be 0. Okay. Good. So I mean, these are just somehow simple reformulation of things happening in the group. I mean, of course, you define tau on the closure of the group algebra, but I mean, if you check something on the group algebra, which essentially means checking it on the group in the end, if you check something there, it goes over to the group algebra and to the closure. So it's really, I mean, all those properties which we have here about tau are more or less simple reformulation of things, of properties which are happening in the group, but reformulated in the language of tau. Okay, but the advantage of tau is that really, I mean, the statements about tau also make sense on the von Neumann algebra. Okay, and that's really what we need, because we want to understand the von Neumann algebra L of G. Okay, so maybe we have a break now of 10 minutes, and then I continue. So, yeah, now I want to come to freeness. So, okay, so the idea was we have this phenomenal algebras of groups, in particular the free group factors, and we would like to understand somehow the free product which we have on the level of groups in this context. We would like to understand what this means on the level of the phenomenal algebras. Okay, but it's, as I said before, we can't really expect an algebraic formulation on the level of the phenomenal algebras because we have to deal with infinite sums. So the idea is that we should rewrite the what it means on the groups, on the group algebra. We should rewrite this into something which involves the state tau, and then, I mean, if you have something there, then this should also go over to the phenomenal algebra. Okay, and that's actually this notion of freeness, which I think you have seen in the first lecture, appearing in the context of random matrices. But the same notion shows up in the context of operator algebras, or actually, I mean, this notion was defined in the context of operator algebras because it was observed by Wakulescu in the free group factors. So in the free group factors. So freeness in the free group factors. Yeah, so maybe let me start by just defining formally the notion of freeness. And actually, I mean, this notion is really, it can be, we don't need phenomenal algebras or normal faithful states. We need just algebras and linear functional. Oh, okay, so it's much better to make the definition more general in this context. So let us just assume that A is a unitary algebra containing a 1, and phi is a linear functional on C, which is also unitary in the sense that 1 is mapped to 1. So it should be a unitary linear functional. So unitary means that phi of 1 goes to 1. And then this notion of freeness is a relation for subalgebras in our big algebras. Right? In the same way if I have groups which are free in a bigger group, so it's a relation between the subgroups. So in the same way, we consider unitary subalgebras sitting in A. So let us denote them by A1 up to AN. So if we have N unitary subalgebras sitting in A, and then we say that they are free. They are free. Now very special definition, which of course we still have to justify that it really makes sense in this context. So we say these are free that whenever that phi applied to some special words is zero. So if I apply phi to special products A1 up to AK, that this is zero whenever, I have a product of a special form, namely each of these A here must come from one of the subalgebras. So A1 is from one of the subalgebras, let's say from AI1 and so on. AK is also from one of the algebras, let's say AIK. And then we assume that neighboring elements here are coming from different algebras. So we really want to have essentially alternating elements. Neighbors shouldn't come from the same algebra, but from different ones. So this means that I of J is not the same as I of J plus 1. So the element AJ and the element A of J plus 1 are coming from two different of the subalgebras. So this should be true for all neighbors here. J running from 1 up to K minus 1. And then, in addition, I assume that phi on each of those guys is equal to 0. So I'm taking products of alternating elements from the subalgebras. Each of them has to be centered, so it must vanish under phi, and then freeness requires that phi also on the product has to vanish. Phi of aj should be 0 for all j from 1 up to k. So that's a formal definition, and I mean the next proposition I will justify, that this is really a situation which happens if I have a free group of groups around. But let me just emphasize that of course this is not an algebraic condition, but it's really, I mean, definition is in terms of phi. So this is really something about the moments of our random variables here. It's putting some structure on the moments. It's some relations which connect various moments of the random variables. So it's not an algebraic condition, but it really depends on phi. If things are free with respect to one phi, of course if I change phi, they are in general not free anymore. Good. Okay, but so that was the formal definition of Vaculescu, but what was the motivation? The motivation was that in a sense, this is again, in the context of our phenomenon algebras, of the groups, this is again a reformulation with respect to our canonical state tau of the fact that I have a free product of groups around. Okay. So namely, let us consider a free product of groups. So let us assume that T is a free product of, let's say, subgroups, yeah. Be a free product of subgroups, G1 up to Gn, sitting in G. So this means that, I don't have any non-trivial relation between the various G's here. So one way of saying this is that if I take products, alternating products of elements from each of the G's, and the element is not the neutral element, and I multiply such things, then I have no chance to get the neutral element in the end. So that's what the free product of groups means. So it is really just an algebraic condition. It means that there are no non-trivial relations between the various groups here. Okay, but now we translate this to the corresponding group algebra. So at the moment, let me just go to the group algebra, because we know essentially if I have a statement involving tau in the group algebra, usually it goes over to the closure. So essentially what I really have to check is things on the level of the group algebra. So tau of A, as before, is this vector state with respect to the neutral element on the group algebra, C of G. Of course, C of G acting on the Hilbert space L2 of G, as we did it before. And then, of course, in C of G, so C of G is now essentially my big algebra A, and the small algebras, the sub-algebras, are the group algebras of the C of GI here. So I have the C of GI up to C of GN. I have them sitting as sub-algebras in C of G. And the statement here is that actually the sub-algebras are free in the sense of this definition with respect to tau. And those are free. And of course this free is now in this sense, it's not algebraic, but of course it's with respect to a state. And the canonical state which we have here is this tau. Good. Okay. And again, this is a very simple observation, and it's just the transfer of this here to the level of tau. So let us prove this. Okay, so what do I have to do? I have to check this relation here as in the definition of freeness. So I should take elements in my group algebras which fulfill these conditions, and I should check that phi or tau on the product is equal to zero. Okay, so let me consider the A's. So the A's should be from some of the group algebra, so they are linear combinations of group elements. So let me take AJ. So this is a linear combination of alpha G. Let me put a J here. G, and the G is here running over the group IJ. So this should be in the group with index IJ. Okay, so this is an element in the group algebra of GIJ. Okay, and I should take elements of this kind. Okay, so each of them should be in one of the group algebras. Okay, it's here in the group algebra IJ. Then I should assume that neighbors are from different group algebras. So as I have here, so I should assume that I of 1, so the first, that A1 is in a different group algebra than I2, and so on. So neighbors should be from different group algebras, and I should also assume that those guys are centered, so tau on AJ should be 0 for all j. Okay, but what does it actually mean that tau of aj is equal to 0? I mean tau, by linearity, tau of this is the sum of the alpha g's, tau acting on g, and what does tau? Tau actually just looks whether the element which I have, if it's an element from the group, it just looks whether it's a neutral element or not. So this means if I apply tau here, on this side, I just remain with the term which corresponds to E. Okay, but I'm asking that this should be equal to 0, which means the coefficient here of the neutral element has to be equal to 0. So tau of such a thing equal to 0 just means that the coefficient of the neutral element must be equal to 0. All the other ones can be whatever they want. Okay, so this condition just means that alpha of E of J is equal to 0. So the coefficient of the neutral element in all those sums must be equal to 0. So I'm taking elements from the group algebras which essentially don't contain components of the neutral element. Good. Okay, and now I should multiply those guys and apply tau again and see that this is equal to 0. Okay, but what is tau now applied to A1 up to AK? Okay, so this is tau and the A's, I'm just plugging in what they are. So this is the sum over, let's say, alpha G1, 1 G1. So let me denote the summation index for the first element by G1, for the next one by G2, and so on. So this is this. I'm just taking those products, the sum over, so here I'm summing over G1, here I'm summing over GK, of alpha GK, K, GK. Okay, then of course I'm just multiplying it out, and so this is the same. And sum, I'm summing over all the g's. So g1 is from gi1 up to gk is from gik. Then I get the product of all the alphas, alpha g1, 1 up to alpha gk, k. Okay, and then I apply tau to the corresponding product of the g's here. Okay, I'm multiplying the g's and I apply tau. So it's tau g1 up to GK. Okay, and I want to see that this guy is equal to 0. Okay, I'm summing over many terms here, and of course I want to see that each of the terms is equal to 0. Okay, and how can one term here be equal to 0? It can be 0 because the product of the coefficient is 0, or because tau on this guy is 0. Okay, and of course, I mean, the only thing we know about the coefficients is that they are 0 if the G is the neutral element. So this means if one of the G's here is the neutral element, then I know that this guy here is equal to 0. Okay. So this remains to see that if I have here the term where none of the G's is equal to the neutral element, then it must be 0. But this is now just the freeness of the group. So I have to... Now what I have to see... Yeah. So if I assume that the coefficient here is different from 0, or... Yeah, it's not necessarily equal to 0 if this product alpha of GK K is not 0. This means that all the G's which I have here must be different from the neutral element, because otherwise the coefficient would be equal to 0 by this. Okay, so but then this means if I multiply those guys, so I'm multiplying elements from the various groups such that neighbors are from different groups, and I know now that none of the G's is a neutral element. So I'm multiplying things which each of which is not a neutral element, neighbors are coming from different groups, but then that the groups are free means exactly that I have no chance that this product is a neutral element. Okay, so this means that if I'm multiplying those things, what I get is a group element which cannot be the neutral element. So this means if I'm multiplying G1 up to GK, this cannot be the identity. And because each of the G's is different from the identity, and neighbors are from different groups. And the fact that the groups are free means exactly this. This is one possibility of defining what it means that groups are free. Okay, so this means it's different from the neutral element, but then if I apply tau to this guy, tau checks whether it's a neutral element or not, if it's a neutral element, it will be 1, but if not, then it will be 0. But this means, of course, power of such a thing is 0. So this means whenever, possibly, this guy here is different from 0, then this guy here must be equal to 0. Okay. So this means that tau on this product must be equal to 0, and this is 0. This means, I mean, either this is 0 or this is 0 for any possibility here, so of course this whole sum is equal to 0. So we see that tau of A1 up to AK is equal to 0. And that's what we have to show. Huh? So we have to take this special product, the elements of the A's under these conditions, and we have to see that they are equal to 0. And yeah, so we see that actually, I mean, this definition here at least makes sense in the sense that there is a situation where such a thing appears. I mean, of course, if you make a definition like this, I mean, it's not actually clear that you find any situation where such a strange definition applies. Okay, but of course, I mean, the observation of Vaculescu was, of course, I mean, here I have such a situation, so I can make this definition. There's at least one situation where I see something like this. And then, of course, later he observed that actually there are at least two very different situations where I can observe something like this, namely also in the context of random matrices. Okay, but I mean, in the beginning, you only had this situation here around, and the point now, of course, is that we have somehow succeeded in translating this this free product of the groups from the group level, that's just an algebraic condition. We have translated this into a statement which involves tau, and now you can, of course, extend this to the Feynman algebra. So the same statement goes over to the Feynman algebras. So in a sense, I mean, you can formulate on the level of the Feynman algebras what it means that you have a free product around. Okay. And maybe I formulate this in the next proposition, that actually if you have freeness on algebra, that it extends to the C star and the Feynman algebra level. I mean, of course, it's just a simple approximation argument. But I will leave the proof of this as an exercise. So this will be one of the exercises. So maybe in the exercise, I think they were originally due today, but I think we extended the handing in of the first set of exercises until next week. And then next week, I mean, I think we will hand out the second problem set. Yeah, so let me formulate this as a proposition, which of course is quite important, that actually freeness, if we observe it on the level of algebra, it really extends to various closures. So let us assume that A is a C-star algebra, and I have a state on it, and I assume, okay, now I'm looking on sub-algebras, but which are only algebras or star algebras, not necessarily a C-star algebra. So let B1 up to B2 in A be unital star sub-algebras, so not necessarily closed in any topology, and I assume they are free, which are free. Of course, with respect to phi. I mean, if I have a fixed phi around, if I say free, I always mean with respect to this phi. Okay, and then I'm claiming that the freeness actually goes over to the closure. So if I take now AI as the closure, the BIs in the operator norm, then of course those are now C star subalgebras of C, and then I'm claiming those guys are also free. Okay, then A1 up to AN are also free. Okay. Of course, this means, I mean, I have to check this condition now for more elements. I have to check it for elements which are in the C-star algebra. And a priori, I only know it for elements which are in the algebra. Of course, this is just an approximation problem. Huh? So I know it on the algebra, and then I have to see that by approximating things, I can transfer the same one to this guy. And the same I can do on the Feynman algebra level. Of course, I mean, there I should have the right continuity property of phi. I mean, there it should be normal. I mean, a state on a C-star algebra is always continuous in the in the norm, so I don't have to ask there for continuity. But on the phenomenon algebra level, I should ask for the right kind of continuity, so it should be normal. So if M is a phenomenon algebra, the same setting as before, but now I should have a normal state. And again, I consider star subalgebras sitting in M. You need to star subalgebras, and I assume they are free. And then I'm claiming again it goes over to the closure, but now even to the closure in a strong or weak topology, so to the generated phenomenon algebra. So MI should be the phenomenon algebra generated by BI. So the essentially the okay, if I have realized on the Hilbert space the closure in the corresponding topology. And I'm again claiming that those phenomenon subalgebras are also free. Okay, and the proof of this will be one of the exercises. I mean, it's not too hard, but you just have to approximate things in the right way. Okay, so this was somehow the motivation of Voiculescu for introducing this concept of freeness. But of course, I mean, a priori, I mean, it's just an observation which you see in this phenomenon algebra, and a priori it doesn't tell you much. I mean, what you now really want to do is to try to understand this notion of freeness better. And then, I mean, maybe later come back to phenomenon algebra questions. I mean, just with this definition, you don't know, it doesn't help you anything about the phenomenon algebra, but I mean, you really have to develop this concept and get a much deeper understanding of it. Okay, and that's what free probability is essentially about, namely really to trying to understand this notion of freeness. I mean, given the fact that it's really, I mean, a meaningful concept. I mean, if you just make this definition, I mean, it is not clear whether there's much more to say about this. But it has turned out that this freeness property is really a quite deep property which has a lot of interesting features. And yeah, I want to start now a little bit about just getting a feeling for the basic properties of freeness. So next week I will go more into a little bit deeper into the structure of freeness. But let us start today just by getting some kind of feeling about what freeness really means. And the general philosophy in this context is that freeness really, I mean, one should consider it as a kind of a probabilistic concept. So one really should see it in analogy to the classical concept of independence. And I mean, a lot of things which are done in free probability theory somehow are inspired by this analogy. So you have a lot of results in classical probability theory of which you have, quite surprisingly, a free analogs. So essentially, if you replace classical independence by freeness, very often there are free analogs. But sometimes it's not really obvious how to do it. I mean, it's not just a straightforward automatic translation. In particular, the proofs usually are not just there's no functor for the proofs. It's not just that if you have proved something on a classical side, that you have automatically proved it on a free side. It's more that you take inspiration from the classical theory. And of course, I mean, you also take notations from there. I mean, we really use a lot of notations which you're using in classical probability theory. So, I mean, for example, I mean, instead of freeness, very often we also talk about free independence. So that's the same, huh? So free independence. And of course, I mean, yeah, let me, some other notations maybe. We are talking about probability spaces, and I mean, this is a very simple notation. So I mean, by a non-commutative probability space, we just mean a pair of a unitary algebra and a unitary linear functional. So I mean, we call it a non-commutative. So very often we just drop the non-commutative probability space. If just A is a unitary algebra and phi is a unitary linear functional on A. Oh, okay, so that's just the setting which I have for making my definitions. Then, of course, in many instances, I have an algebra which might be a C-star algebra or a Feynman algebra, and maybe it's good to have also names for those. So I'm calling such a guy a C-star probability space. If A is a C-star algebra, and then, of course, phi really should have the positivity property, so it should be a state. Oh, okay, so if A is a C-star algebra and phi is a state, and then I mean a Feynman algebra probability space, or W-star probability space, is of course a situation where A is a Feynman algebra, and then I mean you should ask phi, okay, should be normal, and I mean, okay, it's not so clear whether it should require to be faithful or not. I mean, I'm including it here in the definition. So in such a context, usually I want the faithful state. But I'm not sure whether this is really coherent in the literature, so one should be a little bit careful about this. So if A is a Feynman algebra, and phi is a faithful normal state. So if phi is a trace, then I might call it a tracial W star probability space. Okay, and so on. And then, I mean, I'm also talking about random variables, but of course random variables are just the elements in my algebra which I consider. Huh? So if I'm talking about random variables, this just means nothing else than just taking elements from my considered algebra. And of course I also introduced before the notion of moments and distribution. So this also has this probabilistic flavor. Okay, so at least we are using a kind of probabilistic language, but of course, I mean, you should be aware that usually the elements which we consider don't commute. So it's really typical, they are typical operators on Hilbert spaces. And they don't commute. Of course, a classical case where you would have commuting functions on your real probability space is somehow included in this kind of definitions, in this general one. But usually, at least in the context of free probability theory, our random variables don't commute. Good. Okay, but now let us really start to look a bit closer. What is freeness? I mean, what does it tell us? I mean, the definition of freeness is quite, maybe, not too illuminating on the first look. And one should really see it in a sense as one can see the classical notion of independence, which gives me a rule for mixed moments in my independent random variables. Well, I mean, the expectation of product of independent random variables factorizes. Okay, and in the same way, or in an analogous way, the definition of freeness gives me somehow a rule for calculating mixed moments of my random variables. So I mean, this is an observation. First thing one should observe, that actually, if I know that some algebras are free, then I am able to calculate any mixed moment in elements from those algebras in terms of the moments within those algebras. Or maybe to put it more formal, so if I have a probability space, B phi, be a non-commutative probability space, and I consider unitary sub-algebras, A1 up to AN and B, and I assume they are free. Of course, with respect to this phi. Okay, and then by A, I denote the algebra which is generated by those guys. Of course, this B might be very big. Of course, if I know that those guys are free, I can only say something about things which are generated by them. Okay, so let me denote this by A. So this is the algebra generated by A1 up to AN. And then the claim is that phi restricted to A, that this is actually determined by the knowledge of the phi restricted to any of the AI and the freeness condition. So phi of A, I mean, this is the knowledge of all moments from on words from A, which are mixed moments, and because I mean I can mix elements from all the various A's, but I'm claiming that this is determined by the knowledge of phi restricted to A1, phi restricted to A2, and so on, up to phi restricted to An, and the freeness condition, and the knowledge that those guys are free. So this tells me essentially that mixed moments are determined by the moments within each of those algebras. Okay, I mean, this is a quite simple, but nevertheless, of course, fundamental observation. Because, I mean, it's not a priori clear from the definition. I mean, the definition of freeness only tells me that under special situations, moments are zero. So what I have to see is that any moment I'm interested in can be essentially reduced to this definition. Good. Okay, so what is the moment I'm interested in? So what are the elements in A? Of course, elements from A are generated by product inverts of these AIs, and of course linear combinations. But of course it's enough to take words in those guys, because I mean phi is linear. So okay, so the elements in A, so this is the proof. So the elements in A are linear combinations of words of the form which are products A1 up to AK, where each AI here comes from one of the subalgebras. So where AJ, let's say, comes from the subalgebra AIJ. And of course I can assume that neighbors are coming from different ones, because otherwise I would just multiply them and given you a name to them. Okay, so I can assume that I1 is different from I2, and so on. But of course, I mean, in general, I cannot assume that phi on each of them is equal to zero. Okay, that's not the case. Okay, and you see, so what I'm doing in the definition of freeness is I'm telling you what is phi on such words if I make the additional assumption that phi on each of them is equal to zero. Okay, a general word in A, of course, I don't have this extra condition. So what I have to show is that I can reduce such a general situation to this special situation. Okay. Good. Okay, so I'm claiming that I know how to calculate phi on such a guy whenever I know how to calculate phi within the separate A's and using this definition. So I need to calculate phi of A1 up to AK for such words. Okay. And the definition of freeness doesn't tell me directly what this is. Okay, but the trick which I have to do is I essentially have to go over to the corresponding product of centered words. Okay, so I mean I should subtract for each of those words its mean so that it disappears under phi. So instead of this word, in which I'm really interested, I should consider a word for which the definition of freeness applies. Namely, I take A1 and I subtract phi of A1 times the identity. Oh, okay, so this is still an element in the subalgebra A of I1, but now phi applied to this guy is equal to zero, because I just subtracted this. Okay, and so I multiply all those guys, all those centered things, phi of AK times 1. So I multiply all of them together, and I mean, with these words, I'm exactly in a situation which I consider the definition of freeness. So I have alternating words coming from different subalgebras, and phi on each of them is equal to zero. And then the definition of freeness tells me, in this situation, phi of this product is also zero. Okay, so at least I know what this guy here is. This is zero. And of course, this guy contains somehow the information about what I'm interested in. And now, if I multiply this out, then of course I get somehow the term A1, A2 up to AK. So this is now phi of A1 up to AK. But then of course I have a lot of other terms. Okay, but the point now is that those other terms have a smaller length than A1 up to AK. Well, I mean, because at some positions I have the phi. There's just the 5 times the identity, which I just can take out. And then I have something which is smaller, and maybe two neighboring words are from the same algebra, so I can even give a new name to this. So what I get here are other terms, which are somehow of the same nature, but the length of the factors is smaller. So I can do a proof by induction on the length of the words. So I get here, I get a lot of lower order terms, but nevertheless, in principle, by induction, I can assume that I know how to deal with those. So I know this one, I know this is so, but this tells me that I also know this one. Okay, so by induction, in principle, I can calculate all those words. So okay, this here is already known. So I can do an induction element and improve by induction. Okay, and I will do a few some example of this to make this maybe a little bit clearer. But that's somehow the basic observation that you really can reduce every situation in the algebra to the situation where you have the product of centered words just by the centering procedure and induction. Okay, good. So let me do a few examples, but maybe before I do this, let me also make this definition of freeness for random variables itself. Up to now I have only defined what does it mean that subalgebras are independent. This is like are free. This is like saying that sigma algebras are independent. And of course, I also want to say that random variables, element in my algebra, are free. And of course, I'm just doing this by saying that the generated algebras are free. But let us do this, put this down as a formal definition. So if I have a non-commutative probability space, then I say that elements or random variables A1 up to AN in this algebra are free, or we might also say freely independent. That means to say if the unitary subalgebras which they generate are free. If A1 up to AN in A are free, where AI is just the algebra which is generated by 1 and AI. So it always should be the unitary subalgebras that should contain the 1, but it's just polynomials with constant coefficient in the AI. If those guys are free, and we know what it means that subalgebras are free. Good, okay, but then, now we can look on some examples of these calculation procedures. Okay, so let's say A and B are free. A and B are free. Of course, I have a big probability space in the background, and I have phi. I suspect to this should happen. So this, and let us look on a mixed moment, and of course, what is the simplest mixed moment? This is phi of A times B. So what is phi of A times B? And as this proof suggests, we should look on phi of A minus phi of A times 1 times B minus phi of B times 1. So this is an algebra generated by A. This is an algebra generated by B. Those are free. Of course, I assume A and B are free. So this is an alternating word in A and B. And phi of this guy is 0, and phi of this guy is 0. So the definition of freeness means that this has to be equal to 0. Okay, but now we multiply it out, exactly as we did it in this proof. So we get phi of A times B as one term, and then we get three other terms, and the other terms, what is the next term I have here? A multiplied with phi of B times 1. Phi of B is just a number, it comes out. So I have minus phi of B, and then I have phi of A times 1, which of course is just phi of A. Then I have a minus here, phi of A, phi of 1 times B, and then I get this term plus phi of A times phi of B, and phi of 1 times 1, phi of 1. But phi of 1 is 1. Okay, so you see, actually I have this term here 3 times, the term phi of A times phi of B, 2 times is a minus, 1 is a plus, so what I have here is phi of AB minus phi of A times phi of B, and this has to be equal to 0, which means that phi of AB is phi of A times phi of B. Okay, so this tells me how I calculate the mixed moment, this very simple mixed moment in A and B, in terms of a moment of A and a moment of B. And in the same way, one can consider more complicated examples. For example, if I assume that A1, A2 and B are free. Okay. And I mean, in the same way as before, this means the algebra generated by those two guys is free from the algebra generated by B. So if I look on this, and then if I look again on phi of A1 minus phi of A1 times B minus phi of B times A2 minus phi of A2, so this is again alternating what in A's and B's, phi of each is equal to 0, so the fullness tells me that this has to be equal to 0. But if I multiply it out, I will get phi of A1, B, A2, and other terms, but which are of smaller order. So either they just factorize directly, or I have to involve this property here. Okay, but in any case, I can calculate all the other terms, and I mean, again, there will be a lot of cancellations, and in the end, it just comes out that phi of A1, B, A2, nothing else than phi of A1, A2, and phi of A2. Okay, good. And up to this point, it looks quite boring. I mean, this is just the usual factorization from classical theory. I mean, if you would be in a classical theory, if A and B would be independent, of course they would factorize like this. In a classical case, A's and B's would commute if they're independent, so this would be the same as A1 times A2 times B, which would also factorize like this. Okay, so this doesn't look so interesting, but now if you go further and look on the next example, which would be ABAB, then you really get something which is very different from the classical situation. So namely, assume that A1 and A2 is free from B1 and B2, so the algebra generated by those is free from the algebra generated by those, and then let us look on phi of A1, B1, A2, B2, and again, do it in the same way. Start to look on phi of A1 minus phi of A1 times B1 minus phi of B1, A2 minus phi of A2 times B2 minus phi of B2. By the definition of freedom, this is 0. We multiply it out, we get this term, and we get many, many other terms, but all those other terms are determined by what we did before. We know how to deal with them. And again, there will be a lot of cancellations, and we remain with some terms, but not just this one term, but actually there will be three. So namely, it's phi of A1, A2, times phi of B1, phi of B2, plus phi of A1, phi of A2, phi of B1, B2, then minus phi of A1, phi of B1, phi of A2, phi of B2. Okay, so again, this mixed moment we have produced by using the definition of freeness two moments in A and moments in B. Good. Okay. So from these simple examples, which follow directly from the definition, one can see a few things. I mean, first of all, one can see that freeness is somehow analog to independence in the sense that it gives us a rule for calculating mixed moments, but this rule is not a generalization. It doesn't include the classical rule of independence. I mean, very often if you do a non-commutative version of a classical theory, somehow it's a generalization and it includes the classical situation. But I mean, freeness doesn't include independence. Because I mean, if A and B are independent in a classical sense, I mean, then they commute, so then this would be the same as A1 times A2 times B1 times B2, and it would factorize into phi of A1 A2 times phi of B1 B2. But which of course is very different from this rule. Okay, so you see, I mean, it's somehow freeness is analog to independence, but it doesn't include independence. And in a sense, it's also something which doesn't really happen in a classical world. So I mean, from this essentially you can see that if you have commuting variables which are free, then they must be quite trivial. So let me assume that AB is really BA, and then, okay, I mean, then we can calculate phi of, and of course we have that, that this is the same, okay, but now of course we know how to calculate them if they are free, but essentially we have two different rules. Namely, for this one we have this rule, so this is phi of A squared, phi of B squared plus phi of A squared, phi of B squared minus phi of A squared, phi of B squared. But this, on the other hand, I mean, by the same rule as this, factorizes very trivially into phi of A squared times phi of B squared. So we see if we have commuting random variables which are free, okay, then, I mean, we have this equality, but if you subtract this, then this is nothing else than showing that phi of A minus phi of A squared times phi of B minus phi of B squared is equal to 0. So if you just bring this on the other side, it is equal to 0, but this just means this. So this means one of those terms must be equal to 0, let's say this one, but I mean this just means that the variance of A is equal to 0, so A must be a constant. So if A is a classical random variable, and you have two classical random variables and they are free, this means one of them must be almost surely a constant. And of course this is a quite trivial situation. Okay, so constants of course are free, but I mean otherwise you can't find free random variables in a classical world. So freeness is really something which typically only happens for non-commuting operators. Operators on the Hilbert space, but not for classical variables. Okay, and yeah, I mean, so yeah, we have seen that if things commute, then one of them has to be a constant, but on the other hand, constants are actually free from everything. I mean, that's simple observation, which is also very trivial. I mean, that's like for independence. I mean, constants are independent from everything, and the same is true for freeness. So, but maybe it's simple, but nevertheless important. So let us set it down. That if I have a non-commutative probability space, and then if I take the multiples of the identity, so which are the constant random variable, then this is free from anything else, from any unitary B in A. Okay, and the proof of this is very simple. I mean, yes, you have to look at the definition of freeness. So there you have, I mean, what do you have to take? You have to take the product A1 up to NK. That's the definition of freeness. And you have to see that under the conditions that you have there, phi on this word vanishes. Okay, but this is trivially, I mean, if k is equal to 1, then this is trivial, because I mean, you know that phi of A1 is equal to 0. Okay, so I mean, let us consider a k bigger than 2. This means you have, I mean, A1, A2, and so on, and because you have to alternate, at least one of the A's must come from this algebra. Okay, so this means at least one, there's a j, such that aj is in c times 1. So aj is just a multiple of the identity. But on the other hand, we require that each of those guys is centered, so this means that aj must be 0. Okay. Because the only multiple of the identity which vanishes under phi is just 0. Okay, so this means one of the aj's is 0, but then of course if you multiply them with some other a's, you get 0, and if you apply phi, you still get 0. So this means phi on this guy is 0. Okay, so this is very, very trivial, but I mean it tells us that that constant random variables are free from anything. I mean, this is a quite important observation which we will need at a later point. Okay, so I think that's what I wanted to say. I mean, at least we have seen a little bit of what freeness is about and how we should look on it, but I mean, we still don't really understand the structure of these formulas. I mean, we have seen in principle we can calculate all mixed moments, but you see it goes in inductive way, and if you really do this and you have to multiply out, you get a huge number of extra terms, which you can deal with somehow, but I mean you get a lot of cancellations. And you don't know a priori how many cancellations you get. I mean, probably before you really do the calculation, you wouldn't expect this result here. I mean, you couldn't predict that you get those terms. I mean, because if you multiply it out, you will have 16 terms or something like this, or 15 other terms, and you will have a lot of cancellations between them. Also, I mean, it's not really clear how the structure of this formula looks like and whether you really can understand them. And next week I will give you somehow more idea about the structure on threeness, in particular deal with the combinatorial structure which is behind those formulas, which really allows us to understand this quite well. Okay, so that's it for today.